History is littered with last-minute reprieves and stays of execution, but none so timely than for a London criminal in 1705. This is a story of John Smith, or as popular legend came to call him, Half-Hanged Smith. Hi, and welcome back to the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I'm Steve, your host. And the stories of today are about the hanged. And where better to the start than that criminal land north of the border, up in Scotland? Margaret Dixon was born in Edinburgh, circa 1702. She was born into a large family, and she married young to a local Musselburgh fisherman, and they sold their wares and salts and fish around Edinburgh Old Town. In 1722, Maggie's husband vanished, and most believe he was press-ganged into a navy ship. Maggie was left with two children without sustenance or work, so she left her children behind in Edinburgh with family and headed south to visit an aunt in Newcastle. She had an extended break in her journey at the small village of Maxwell Hugh, and there she took work with the Bell family at a pub. And working at the pub, Maggie was in daily contact with the innkeeper's son William Bell, whom she began a relationship. When Maggie found herself pregnant, she didn't tell anyone. She concealed her pregnancy and continued to work. She knew that anyone found out she was pregnant, she would lose her job and be destitute. Apparently, she did not tell her lover about the pregnancy, or if she did, he did nothing to help her in any way. Although alone and pregnant, Maggie was technically still married. Maggie continued to work till the day her child was born in a field where she had gone to give birth in secrecy. Whether the baby was stillborn or died shortly after birth is not known for sure. On the 9th of December 1723, a baby's dead body was found at the side of the River Tweed near the village. It was traced back to Maggie, and she stated the baby had been born stillborn. She kept it in her bed for 8 days, frantic with worry, before throwing it in the river out of sheer distraction. She was arrested and charged with murder before being tried in Edinburgh on the 3rd of August 1724. A quite inexplicable length of time between arrest to trial, to which I couldn't unearth a reason. She was found guilty and heard those words many were to hear in Scots law over the years. You are found guilty, you are to be taken from this place to a place of execution, and there you will be hanged by the neck until you are dead. May the Lord have mercy on your soul. The news of her hanging date ensured that this baby murderer had a huge turnout waiting to see her hanged. And on the 2nd of September 1724, the baying crowd of thousands witnessed the drop at Gallows Stone in the Grass Market. The hangman tugged at her legs for good measure as she swung, and after half an hour she was cut down, placed in a coffin to be taken back to Musselburgh by her friends on a cart. Scarcely they had left Edinburgh outskirts when they were attacked by a gang of body snatchers, surgeons' apprentices seeking booty for dissection. They fought the gang off, but not before the coffin had been disturbed and the lid loosened They pressed on as far as the village of Peppermill and, still somewhat shaken, stopped there for refreshment. Only then did two passing joiners hear a noise from the coffin. It was duly opened, and first Margaret Dixon's limbs twitched. Then Peter Purdy, one of her friends, opened a vein, and a strangled cry of "Oh dear" came from Margaret's deathly pale lips. We digress from the story at this point to look at why they opened a vein. To appreciate the rationale for bloodletting, one must understand the understanding of disease 2,300 years ago. It was a time of Hippocrates, 460 to 370 BC, and he believed that the existence was represented by the four basic elements, earth, air, fire and water, which in humans were related to the four basic humours, blood, phlegm, black bile and yellow bile. Each humour was centred in a particular organ, brain, lung, spleen and gallbladder. And this also related to a particular personality type, sanguine, phlegmatic, melancholic and choleric. Being ill meant having an imbalance in the four humours. Therefore, treatment consisted of removing amount of the excess humour by various means such as bloodletting, purging, catharsis, diuresis and so on. By the 1st century, bloodletting was already a common treatment. Galen of Pergamum, 129 to 200 AD, declared blood as the most dominant humour, and the practice of venesection gained even greater importance. Galen was able to propagate his ideas through the force of personality and the power of the pen. His total written output exceeds 2 million words. And he had an extraordinary effect on medical practice, and his teachings persisted for many centuries. His ideas and writings were disseminated by several physicians in the Middle Ages when bloodletting became accepted as a standard treatment for many conditions. And bloodletting was divided into generalised methods done by venesection and arteriotomy, and a localised method done by scarification with cupping and used leeches. Venesection was the most common procedure and usually involved the medial cubital vein at the elbow, but many different veins could be used. The main instruments for the technique were lancets and phlegms. Thumb lancets were small, sharp-pointed, two-edged instruments, often with an ivory or tortoise shell case that the physician would carry in his pocket. Phlegms were usually devices with multiple, various-sized blades that folded into a case like a pocket knife. Localised bloodletting often involved scarification, and it meant scraping the skin with a cube-based brass box containing multiple small knives, followed by cupping, which involved placing a dome-shaped glass over the skin and extracting the air by suction or prior heating. And the leeches used for bloodletting usually involved the medicinal leech. Each feeding leech can ingest about 5 to 10 mils of blood, almost 10 times its own weight. And the use of leeches was greatly influenced by Dr. Francois Brosset, 1772 to 1838. He was a Parisian physician who claimed that all fevers were due to a specific organ inflammation, and he was a great proponent of leech therapy along with aggressive bloodletting. He believed in placing leeches over the organ of the body that was deemed to be inflamed. And his therapy was very popular in Europe in the 1830s, especially France, where 5 to 6 million leeches per year were used in Paris alone, and about 35 million in the country as a whole. By the late 1800s, however, enthusiasm for leech therapy had waned, but we still see leeches used today in certain situations. When Charles II suffered a seizure, he was immediately treated, with 450 mils worth of bloodletting from his left arm, followed by another 200 mils from cupping. He then endured a vigorous regime of emetics, enemas, purgatives, and mustard plasters, followed by more bleeding. He had more seizures and required further treatment with herbs and quinine. In total, he'd almost 700 mils of blood taken before he died. And another man, George Washington, developed a fever and respiratory distress, and under the care of his three physicians, he had copious amounts of blood drawn, blistering, emetics, laxatives. His medical treatment aroused significant controversy, particularly the bloodletting, as he died the next night of what has been diagnosed retrospectively as epiglottitis and shock. And your epiglottis is the flap in the throat that closes when swallowing that prevents foodstuff or fluids going into the lungs. And itis means inflammation of. But, as I said, I digress. And it's back to our Scottish bird. On the 6th of September, 1724, just 4 days and the Sunday after being hanged, looking remarkably well considering, she attended church in Musselburgh. Amid much sensation, she became a local celebrity, and even some months later, it was announced that she'd remarried her former husband. It should be noted that according to Scots law at the time, sentence was deemed to have been carried out and she was a free woman. Moreover, as she was deemed dead upon being taken down from the gallows, her marriage was automatically dissolved. Those crazy Scots and their crazy laws. By the way, where her husband had reappeared from wasn't indicated anyway either, so just another miracle for Margaret Dixon. She lived another 25 years and always denied killing her child. And we move south of the border this time, and we start in the Yorkshire town of Malton in 1661, when John Smith was born. He was an apprentice to a packer, and then served in the Navy, seeing action at the Battle of Vigo Bay in 1702. On discharge from the Navy, he graduated to that great cesspool of London that's drawn many to its bustling charms. And he'd clearly decided by that time that an honest living wasn't for him, and he decided on housebreaking. But it was a bad career choice, as he proved a wee bit inept. On the 3rd of December, 1705, he was apprehended on suspicion of breaking and entering, and 2 days later was arraigned at the Old Bailey on 4 separate indictments. Each involved theft. Valuable quantities of shoes, cloth, China silk, and 148 pairs of gloves, and each was a capital offence. He requested and prayed for a reprieve when he was found guilty, but this didn't come, and he was taken to Tyburn on the 12th of December, 1705, where the cart he was standing on was driven off, leaving him dangling and strangling. This was known as a short drop, as opposed to the later long drop, which would snap the neck. In the short drop, essentially the lighter someone was, the longer it would take them to strangle to death. For Smith, the hangman pulled his legs, and he also hanged for a full 15 minutes. Then a horseman came rushing in with a reprieve for Smith. It seemed much too late. Smith was cut down and taken to a nearby public house. Again, bloodletting took place, and in a warm bed with compresses, a miracle took place. Slowly, the half-hanged Smith started to revive. He was taken back to Newgate Prison and he quickly became the centre of attention for London, and members of the public queued up and paid to view him as a star exhibit, and he published a sensational account of the hanging. Quote, "My spirits, in a strange commotion, violently pressing up to my head, and in a great blaze of glaring light, which seemed to come out of my eyes with a flash before I lost all sense of pain. When I was cut down, I got such pins and needles pain in my head that I could have hanged the people who had set me free." Smith's reprieve was followed by an unconditional pardon, and he was released from prison on the 20th of February, 1706. And you would have thought this gift from the gods would have changed Smith's outlook in life forever, but alas. For 10 years he managed a respectable life as a publican in Southwark, but the temptation of his old lifestyle drew him back. And in January 1715, he was picked up near Fenchurch Street after breaking into a warehouse. Again, it was a capital offence, and a date at the Old Bailey beckoned. But Smith's charmed life continued. He spent 18 months in Newgate, but at length found not guilty on a technicality. And so it went on. Further crimes followed in 1720 and 1721. But on the first occasion he was acquitted, and for the second offence, he again went back to Newgate. Only in 1727, where he once again transgressed, did the English legal system finally rid himself of the man they called Half-Hanged Smith. 22 years after his famous Tyburn appearance, he was transported to the American colonies in Virginia, where he passes out of documented history. And for other half-hanged people, fate was incredibly cruel. Spare a thought for these historical individuals. John Stowe's Annals of 1592 records the following. On the 20th of February, 1587, a strange thing happened. A man hanged for felony at St. Thomas Wateringe's, being begged by the surgeons of London to have been made of him an anatomy, after he was dead, to all men's thinking, cut down, stripped of his apparel, laid naked in a chest, thrown onto a cart, and so brought from the place of execution through the borough of Southwark over the bridge and through to the city of London to the Surgeons' Hall near Cripplegate. The chest there being opened, and the weather extremely cold, he was found to be alive, and lived till the 23rd of February, 3 days later, and then died. And of Ewan MacDonald, who escaped death, but the anatomist decided they needed him more, and took him back there. In Newcastle in 1752, MacDonald was found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to be hanged and his body to be dissected. After hanging, he revived and sat up later whilst on the dissection table and a scalpel cutting him. He was then struck a blow to the head with a mallet by the surgeon, killing him. The dissection could then be completed. It should be noted that all today's cases took place before the 1760s, when it became standard practice to leave the bodies for an hour to ensure death. And it might be interesting to examine the process of the body on the short drop hanging. Hanging when carried out with little or no drop does not cause instant death. Neither does it cause severe physical damage to the neck, as the forces exerted are far lower, but rather it squeezes the life out of the person over a period of time. This is due to the constriction of the neck causing pressure on the carotid arteries, jugular veins and the vagal nerve, putting pressure on the trachea and forcing the base of the tongue upwards against the palate, both which will cause asphyxia. Respiration does not stop either automatically or totally, but rather reduces in time. Pressure on the carotid arteries can cause a reflex which slows heartbeat and may eventually stop the heart. The vertebrae protects the vertebral and the spinal arteries, which also supply blood to the brain, and thus the brain, in what is a virtually comatose state, does not necessarily become totally starved of oxygen. And the person slowly strangles to death though. And as I say, now you know. Well, that's it for another episode of the Historical Crimes and Criminals podcast. I hope you enjoyed that one. And till next time, bye-bye.